And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started. Well, welcome back, Patty Quatro. Hello, my dear.
Hello.
So before we jump into this episode, which I don't know if the word is excited, but I'm very much looking forward to this episode. I misspoke on the last episode. And I misspoke by saying that the club, that the Pleasure Seekers, went to go see the phenomenal band, Blues Magoos, was at the Chessmate. I misspoke and said it was not in Detroit, but it was indeed in Detroit. Correct, Patty?
Absolutely. It was a Detroit club.
Okay, well, I just wanted to clear the record there for anybody, and you can look them up. It was some great photos of that club, by the way. But Patty, some of our listeners may have noticed that we opened up this episode without any song to set the tone, if you will, for what we intend to talk about, where we intend to go on our journey within an episode. And the reason why we didn't open up this time with a song was that we wanted to pick up on the last song that we focused on in the previous episode. And for those that didn't hear that episode, I always encourage you to listen because we are telling a story here. But we played A Day in the Life by the Beatles, not just because it's the Beatles, but because it's a song within Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band that the Pleasure Seekers covered from beginning to end as an entire set. And so another reason that we wanted to let the song play in its entirety, including that very long reverb at the end, that way it resonates, and to me, and Patty, you agreed with me, we felt it was very... It was dramatic, but there was a point to the drama because we knew and know that on this episode, this amazing spring that the Pleasure Seekers are having back in Detroit and covering all these songs and playing and having this rise, the summer of 1967 is about to unfold. And it's a very different season. The Detroit riots or uprisings or rebellions, whichever word you want to use, now is going to take over and tone or set the tone for a very different moment in Detroit and the Pleasure Seekers and the music and the culture there. So, Patty, as you and I were getting ready for this episode, you had this always, my dear, I overuse this word with you, but brilliant, brilliant insight to A Day in the Life on a larger scale that encapsulates not only you and your family and the city of Detroit, but also this time capsule. So without further ado, I want this floor to be yours and just take it over.
Okay, well, as I look back, the song has always floored me. John Lennon went very serious. So on this episode, I'm going to take up his lead and go to Serious Pat at this point in the podcast, and how it freaked me out a bit. And that crescendo at the end, like leading to a bomb going off, the song for me is like a premonition song. It always has been. I look back on it at this happy, fun album, Happy Spring, Happy Times, but the lyrics by John Lennon are quite a departure from the rest of the album and a bit surreal, because it contrasts daily life routines with life's fragility and suddenness of death, and it makes you consider, at least it did me, the blurred lines between like public and private reality. It has this dreamlike quality to it when you're listening to it, sort of like a detachment, I would say. And it was for me definitely a statement on the very human condition, exploring so many layers. And then in the hot summer day, in the life was like a reverberating alarm at the end of it of something to come, as it became that. It became for me a perfect conduit to a song by the Chamber Brothers, Time. I'm sure you remember that song, which is so hugely respected and thought of through decades. That song is like an 11-minute song, and it's an anthem on anxieties with the passage of time, frustrations, sadness, and the fleeting nature of life. It raises so many questions and issues that came to be in that summer, at that point in time, and all the potential of joy and pain, social and political injustices. It like stands, that time song stands as a call to action in the lyrics, and it questions the boundaries of what we're living. And when I listen to that song, there's such an urgency to it, as well as what they did with the music, the psychedelic music that they put in for 11 minutes. I was very drawn to this song. And the two, they both just freak me out.
Well, I would like to tease that out, as I like to say, because Time happened, the song Time, let me clarify, by the Chamber Brothers, happened as a reflection point. A Day in the Life happened prior. And they're, in a way, song bookends. So what I would like to do is, in the middle of these two songs, you discussed A Day in the Life, and now you've beautifully discussed Time by the Chamber Brothers. This is about the Detroit riots. And so I think what's important is to pull back now and place you, Sirius Pat, Patty Quatro, who has had a third eye since she was young, in an era of what we would call white flight. I am a trained historian. This is a moment where I think Grosse Pointe, where you grew up, which is a very white suburb, it still is to this day, if we can be frank. And it was a part of the flight out of Detroit, which a lot of people saw as unsafe and too integrated, if you will. And so I want to bring you and the Quattro family into this story because I think we have such a unique view because of you and your vision and your voice. So to contextualize you for a second, Patty, you're born in 1948. And in 1954, you're 6 years old, you're little Patty. And that is the huge overturning of Brown versus the Board of Education, which overturned the separate but equal in terms of schooling. And because of that overturning and this law now to force, if you will, schooling and integration, this is when many families who were white did flee, start opening up private schools or making high restrictions or costs where some families couldn't afford. So you're in the middle of this growing up. But I'm curious because the Quattros were a very different family within Grosse Pointe. You were unique. You weren't, yes, you worked, your family worked in the, or your dad worked in the car factory, but he was not of the elite. So he had to work many jobs to support you. And so tell us what it was like for you as a white family growing up in Grosse Pointe during these very, let's just say, racial times, but also a father who was in the music biz, your brother was in the music biz, you're now in the music biz. What was it like, this viewpoint for you?
You know, it's really interesting because you just tweaked a saying that my grandma said. I mean, she came from Italy, okay? And we used to go visit them and they lived on Montclair and it was in Detroit. Okay, this beautiful house on this street, and it was mixed neighborhood very much. And she used to tell us, don't you play with those chocolate babies. She had a fear, you know, that was the point in time. They weren't used to being around black and the races did come in. And I just remembered that. And it freaks me out that she would say that because she was scared.
Absolutely.
She said that to us when we were little kids rolling down the hill on her front lawn. And, you know, there was not really where we lived in Grosse Pointe. There wasn't really interaction with black kids. All the Grosse Pointes, as you said, were very white. And we didn't really assess the situation, except when we went to grandma's house, we heard that. And it was a very white community. There was a lot of resentment growing slowly through that with what you've said about the inequality in jobs and housing and racial tensions. But we were in our Grosse Pointe bubble. My parents were aware of it all. My dad worked his ass off on many jobs because we were not the typical Grosse Pointe family. We had a very average home. And, you know, I would go to Grosse Pointe High with my friends as I became a teen. And their houses were like mansions to me. And I was like, oh my God, you know, because our house was much smaller. But that's what he did to give us a good life. We couldn't even afford the same kind of clothing that those Grosse Pointe kids at the stores they could shop at. So it was a very different thing, but we felt safe, we felt protected, and my parents didn't go into it. We were just so very middle class in that era.
Well, I also touched upon, and I want you to talk about this more. You were middle class, you were in a bubble, all of that totally understandable, but you were not in that much of a bubble as a musical family. And because, I mean, and also Motown came from Detroit. So you also saw black musicians who were playing, and now you're about to start a band and all of that. And so another timepiece I want to focus on with you is if you're growing up in this white suburban bubble in Grosse Pointe, let's now get to this historic moment for Patti Quatro and for music in general. It's now 1964. So we're talking only a decade later from the overturning, right, of this separate but equal. And now integration is being forced. In 1964, let's remind our listeners, Patti, you go to a live performance of the Beatles, which is so funny to me that now you're not only covering them, but analyzing A Day in the Life as a historic piece. But there you are, you have this epiphany, you want to do rock as an all-female band. That is pioneering. And women are also going through all these changes. But also in 1964, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act into law. And all of this is happening within the same year as music is exploding and the British invasion. And look what's happening in Detroit and these homeboys and your friends and all of that. And then a year later, and we are celebrating the anniversary of it this year. Lyndon B. Johnson again signs into law the Voting Rights Act. So we have 64, 65, you and the pleasure seekers are playing everywhere. And now it's 1967. You've had this incredible spring. You're signed to ABC Booking from New York. Sure, you had a mob incident in New Jersey, but what's that? And you come home, and now this is on the cusp. And yet, bring your musical family back into this. You have a wonderful story about your sister Susie going to see an art. I mean, just this is where I want your voice to come into everything that's bubbling up now.
Okay. I don't remember any, I mean, this is weird, but I don't remember any issues playing with any of the musicians due to race. It was a non-issue for my family. I'm sure it was an issue for other families, perhaps, but being in music, that was the magic in the air with the hippie, looser era in full force. There was a lot going on, clubs opening, ballrooms, music everywhere. Music was the universal communication of the day. Even with Motown maybe having a small push-pull with the new rock music, it didn't seem to interfere with any of us musicians to do the gigs. We just enjoyed the scene that spring. And it was the weave that held black and white musicians together for the pleasure seekers and the Quattros, and I'm sure other musicians as well. I remember Susie, the story you're talking about, Susie and her boyfriend Chris, they went to see James Brown downtown, and they were the only white people in the audience. And they had a blast. There was no issue, just the audience enjoying the immense musical talents of James Brown. And she was thrilled. She came home just, oh my God, I saw James Brown. She was a huge fan. That's how it affected her. And nothing happened, nothing bad.
Well, I'm curious about that because we always hear that it's a whites-only club in historic terms. So James Brown is playing at a, I'm assuming, a black-only club, maybe, or no?
No,
But
I
why
think
were they the only whites in the audience?
it's just the way it was. It was a black audience. I can't explain it, but the blacks came to see their idol, James Brown, and Susie wanted to go, so they went.
Wow. Well, I'm going to again keep my professor hat on for one second while I set the stage for everybody. For those who may not know about the Detroit riots, the reason why there's interchange of wording is riots adds to this mystique of segregation as opposed to uprisings or rebellions. That's why. But in historic terms, it's the Detroit riots. And I found a brief encapsulation of it from a lawyer slash historian, Bryan Stevenson, that I love. So let me quote him, and it's brief, I promise. So for those that don't know, quote, "The Detroit Rebellion began after police raided an after-hours club. Looting and fires broke out, and multiple law enforcement agencies were deployed. On July 26, police and National Guardsmen raided the Algiers Motel looking for an alleged sniper. They found not a single gun on the premises, but instead tortured the black men and white women they found there together and killed three black teenagers, shooting two of them at point-blank range. Despite two officers' confessions, no one was ever convicted for their deaths. By the rebellion's end, 33 African Americans and 10 white people had been killed, most at the hands of law enforcement," close quote. And just really quickly, Detroit was not unique. There was a slew of uprisings or rebellions across the country, but Detroit is unique because it's the one that, in a way, was a catalyst. And you are now, you know, a child of Detroit. You grew up there, even if it's in a bubble. And so tell us about this moment. Do you remember the day, it's the night that this all started to happen? Were you playing at a gig? Anything you want to do to tell us and put you in the moment?
This was, as we have said, the summer of love through the entire nation, and it sadly turned into the summer of hate. It was the bloodiest day that ever dawned upon Detroit. We were getting ready to head out to a gig in Buffalo, okay, as this stuff happened. And of course, my parents were probably keeping up with it on the news. We were busy packing and everything. It was like a four-day event with other bands on it. And we prepared for the road trip, and the riots erupted suddenly and took the white communities by surprise. And oh, the police stirred it up with their brutality, and there was the bomb exploding. Different escalations happened with lives lost. There was a lot of looting. Each day it got worse. And though it was confined very much to the 12th Street area, it was moving toward Grosse Pointe. Of course, my parents heard that on TV and they were scared. They didn't, excite us, but they watched the news and they knew what was happening. Buildings were on fire and shooting going on, just madness and mayhem. We were glad that we were getting out of town quick and concerned that we leave quickly because of the way it was escalating. And they decided they were going to come with us.
Your parents decided.
Yes, they did not want to stay behind. And they were scared even for us traveling on the freeway going through to Buffalo. That's where we were going for a gig. So they didn't even have time or take the time to board up our house or do anything. We just left. And there was so much concern about whether we would come back and what condition our home might be in. We didn't know. We got out of town quick.
Well, and I just want to say this, not this is not a judgment about the Quattros. This is a judgment about the news that was being reported at the time by nothing but white people who were putting the fear of God into white folk and saying, uh-oh, things are getting heated here and scary. And so, of course, your father and mother would respond to this. They wanted you to be safe. And so on this gig, your parents are now accompanying you and you're driving to Buffalo. Just to lighten the mood for a second in this, what did you say, madness and mayhem moment. So on the bill is none other than Mr. Chuck Berry. And I want you to tell, so again, this is in the middle of the outpouring of the Detroit riots. You're in Buffalo. Your parents have joined you. They're scared because of the news. You go to this gig. So tell us the Chuck Berry story.
We played at a big venue called, of all things, the Inferno. That's what the club was called. I mean, you can't write this stuff, I'm telling you. It was very popular, and Chuck Berry was on the final night bill with us. We shared the back room, and we were having a blast when an incident occurred backstage. And I don't know what provoked it. I can't remember that. But Chuck was real friendly. We were having fun, a little too much so, and was fooling around. And he ended up laying across Eileen. And they were laughing over something. In walks my dad. You know, my dad has the look of an Italian mob guy. That's just what he looks like. And he went ballistic.
I want to hear your dad, because I just don't want anybody to. Okay, so because your sister Arlene is very different than Eileen Bidlingmeyer, your guitarist, yes. And so this is Eileen Bidlingmeyer that Chuck Berry is now lying on top of. Your father, the wannabe mob look guy, walks in. Okay, now say it.
Oh my God. So he said, "What the hell are you doing? Get off her." Oh my God, he was so furious. It very nearly came to blows as my dad was ready to punch out Chuck Berry. Very tense moments. And like I'd say, that was the night Chuck turned white. And he'd never let me forget it whenever I saw him again through decades at a gig or something or at a festival. I mean, he was out of there like a shot.
I love that that you and Chuck Berry can laugh about this incident. I have to say that is hilarious. The night Chuck turned white. Well,
Oh
but you know what I have to say? I mean, it does speak to, and this is truly not a put down. It's a generational thing. My grandparents were very much the same way. Your father may have been really enlightened. My father was really enlightened, but there was that no. That was at a moment in time where miscegenation, which means, interracial marriage,
yeah.
think about actually, if you think about 1967 when all of this is happening, that is when the law case with Loving versus, it's when the interracial marriage, that couple, Loving.
Yes, and
So,
I'll add to that. Sorry to interrupt.
no.
There's one thing. My dad, he was of course in an excited manner anyway because of what was happening in Detroit to see a black person laying on top of one of his band girls. And the odd thing, as time went on, because he wasn't like my grandparents. They came from Italy. They didn't know this racial mixing. They just didn't. And my dad, in later years, his two best friends in his life were two black men that he loved dearly. They were his friends. I mean, it
Well,
all
again, it's
happened
not a
through
put down.
time. It took time. Yeah.
It took time and it was the time. And so it's, I mean, it's something, it's a conversation that I think always needs to be had within historical context because we have to remind ourselves what the landscape was at that time. And I
Yes.
think you just said it perfectly that at the time that was, and I think you said it as well perfectly, that your father's head was now clouded by the Detroit riots, which he and your mother had to flee from to go to this Buffalo gig. And so, wow, you've had this moment with Chuck Berry, which we will now remember forever, or I guess Eileen did.
Oh God, we needed the black humor. It's a
Yes.
curious episode, but we did that helped.
It helped. We have to have a little bit of levity just to kind of also, because, we have to laugh sometimes. We need it. But I'm curious because obviously this was all over the news. And so after the gig, and you said it was a few days, right? The gig that you did. So now you're coming back to Detroit and now you're coming back to your white suburban bubble of Grosse Pointe, not knowing. Because we don't have, you didn't have the same kind of coverage that we would have now. So what happened next?
Well, the National Guard came in because my parents kept up with the news and they quelled it. Once they came in, they put a stop and there was a lot of destruction, and you've already mentioned all that. So we came home. I remember being a bit freaked out at how quickly that the riots had escalated when I really got the whole story. It was a real world moment for me about these issues that definitely existed in Detroit, despite them not having touched me or my family in a real way, a daily life way. The underbelly was non-existent at that time for me in my Grosse Pointe bubble, but now it was. I had to realize in a more adult way what could happen in our world despite us being in music.
Wow. And that's a heavy lesson for you to learn.
Yes,
And
very.
in only a few short months, you went from a real life world experience of a New Jersey mob incident. And then now
Oh,
you're coming home. You're coming home to Detroit and your city, it burned. It was burning. And you can trace it back before the riots in Detroit. But I have to say, now that I'm living here, it's still recovering from it. And yes, I think the city is having a bit of a renaissance, and I'm so excited.
yeah.
And I am Detroit's biggest fan. But I still, the seeds of the Detroit riots are definitely uprisings, rebellions, whatever we're calling it, I think are definitely still here. And I think it's definitely we need to look at. But you said something about how with, you know, your daily life. It wasn't something that was necessarily right in front of your face. But I think in a way you went from this day in the life to, in a way, a week in the life of Patty Quatro and the Pleasure Seekers. And you have this Chuck Berry moment, which, as funny as it is really intense if you think about the historic moment you're in and how different what you all went through as musicians. And now we are talking about this song Time by the Chamber Brothers, which we are with, we don't even need to say it. We're definitely going to be closing with it. This is a song, Patty, that's very important to you, as all the songs that we have chosen. But I do now want to make this reflection of you started off with the day in the life with the Beatles, this ho hope and happiness that then turns into this serious resonance at the end, this bam of reality. And now you've just lived through a week of your city, the underbelly showing itself, and you can't put a band-aid on that anymore. So tell us a little bit as we listen to the Chamber Brothers song Time, that was a reflection of the Detroit riots, and Wayne Kramer of MC5's quote about this was the summer of hate versus many others were experiencing the summer of love. So I would like again to give you the floor before we listen to the song and give us your final reflections on this. I please.
You know, I said in another episode that getting out of college was like a rounding out educationally. I mean, how important that comes back to my mind right now, because it was the mob, this riot thing. I mean, what a real world education I had when I left college. Very different. And what are the odds of Detroit burning? And very oddly, the venue we played called the Inferno. I mean, you can't, like I said, you can't write this stuff. And a Day in the Life song fed so prominently as a premonition that spring and so masterfully illuminated our protected, encapsulated musical world at that time. And then here comes the time. You know, that song was recorded in 66, released again in 67, and in 68 again. It is so respected when you look it up. So much was written on it and what it meant. And you hear the tick tock, like a heartbeat. That song came for me to be a turning point. Such a turning point.
Well, I want to hear more about that, but I do have to say that you just said something that fits into this entire conversation. The
Yes.
band wrote the song in 66, then released
Yes.
it again in 67, then
Yeah.
released it again in 68. And if you think about it, in 66, they were talking about something very different because the riots hadn't happened yet in 67. And after the riots happened all over the country in 67, now, looking back on it through the lens of 1968 is even more profound. So, talk to us before we listen to this song, because I just think your analysis is so brilliant, Patty.
You know, it's interesting what you just said because there you go. That underbelly had always been there, you know, burbling up as the years go by. So it's interesting to me that it got released three times. And it was such a conduit for me personally, how Day in a Life, and then in the spring, and then into the summer of hate. So I will end in saying from this very serious Pat on a rather serious episode here. You know, it was a conduit to two wake-up calls that I felt in a very profound way, no matter when they were released or anything. That's what happened in spring and summer. And those deep memories of that spring and summer pretty much escalated also my human experience of the adult world I had to now inhabit. I still remain very much of a Pollyanna to not lose faith in humanity. I believe that this incident was the start of a turning point in my wanting to write about meaty, relevant lyrics as I continued my musical journey. I recall the relevant lyrics of both turns and what we are living, Kristen, even now. Does there remain even any chance, I ask hopefully in my Pollyanna skin, that humanity will make some real necessary progress on every level in this what should be a we world, not a me world planet that we all have to inhabit? My answer is the clock is ticking. Tick tock, tick tock.